My castaway this week is a man of the church. His path to the top of the ecclesiastical hierarchy has been unusual, but no one could accuse him of not understanding the lives of those more disadvantaged than his own. He's the son of a hospital porter from the East End of London. He left school at 15 with no qualifications and worked in an electricity showroom and as a wireless operator in the RAF before entering the church. Today he wrestles with the issues of female ordination, homosexuality and religious apathy, reflecting that while he didn't choose his job, he's never run away from any challenge in his life. He is the Primate of All England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Most Reverend Dr. George Carey. Not only did you not choose your job, Archbishop, you were in fact the 25-1 outsider, I think, in early 91. How surprised were you when the call came?
Yes, I was aware that I was very much an outsider, and I was very surprised too when the invitation came. And as you said a moment ago, I've never run away from any challenge, and this was certainly a challenge.
But was it one you wanted? It certainly wasn't one you expected.
I was very happy. Being a diocesan bishop of Bath and Wells, a very happy diocese. So, no, I wasn't looking for a new challenge, particularly at that particular time.
So was there any part of you that thought, yes, this is a wonderful opportunity and I am deeply flattered to have this invitation, but actually there's part of me that wishes it hadn't come?
As I saw the opportunities for leadership in the Church of England, and especially in the 90s, where the entire Anglican Communion were focusing on the decade of evangelism, I saw this as some contribution I could make, because that is very much at the heart of my mission, to make the Church more outward-looking, more vibrant, more confident in itself. And so, if you like, I saw that as a deep attraction.
But that sounds like totally a sense of duty.
Well, duty is very much part of the Christian calling and not to be despised. But at the time, while I had that sense of duty about it, there was a sense of, well, this is an unexpected opportunity and, of course, I'll take the offer up.
I only press you on that because you've always said that you enjoy people, that you've enjoyed your job in the church because it's brought you in direct contact with people, which is, of course, what you would get very little of, presumably, as Archbishop.
Well, you may think so, Sue, but in fact, actually, I make it my effort to get to know people around the world and in this country. In my diocese, I do what I call teaching missions. I go into the parishes and the deaneries. I try to mix with ordinary people. And my family make sure I'm very much down to earth.
Right, let's turn to music now. Tell me about the first record you've chosen.
Well, I grew up in the war years. I was 10 when war ended. It was a very traumatic time for any Londoner. And one of the great memories I have, not only of the great warmth of community in London, but also the music at the time, and I've chosen Joe Loss and his orchestra, A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square.
There was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
A nightingale sang in Berkeley Square with Joe Loss and his orchestra and Paula Green singing there. You would have been Archbishop IV when war
broke out. Yes, I was.
Does that mean that, in a sense, war was quite fun for you? Because for a boy of that age and onwards, so, you know, there were sort of fine times to be had.
Yes, I have to say there were aspects to it that were very exciting indeed. You know, looking out at night and seeing the searchlights scan the sky and the noise and so on, and the call to get down into the shelter, and down in the shelter you went and you peered outside. But as well as that, of course, there was the sadness that went with it, going to school perhaps the following morning to find your friend was not there, or someone had been killed in the bombing before. So that went along with it. And then the evacuations that happened as well.
But you weren't evacuated.
I was evacuated a few times to Warminster and Bradford-on-Avon. And well, remember that. Wasn't always exciting then. Change of schools, that was traumatic.
And leaving your parents behind.
Well, only on one occasion, actually. On the second and third occasion, my mother came with us. My father was working for Ford's Motor Company, and so he had to get on with his job.
What about your brothers and sisters? Because there were a lot of you, weren't there?
Yes, I'm the oldest of five, so I bossed them around. But yes, it was hard on my mother.
But what sort of young boy were you? Were you one of the lads, or would you have stood apart?
Oh, yes, very much indeed. Oh, yes, nothing different about me. And played football in the street and the banjo around where we lived and so on, yes.
And the family? Strong sense of family, East End, knees ups?
Tremendous sense of community and a very happy family life. I mean, my mother and father had very little to do with organised Christianity, but in their own way, as I look back now, very devout people, believers in God, believing in prayer. But, in a way, the church was quite a distant thing from them. Although I have to say that when we went to Bradford-on-Avon, it was the local church community there that befriended my mother and all of us. And I think if there was a start to my Christian pilgrimage, it began with that church school in Bradford-on-Avon.
Your father apparently wrote pop lyrics, didn't he?
Yes, he did. How did you know that? Yes, he certainly did. And there was one occasion when we had a song published, and he was so proud of it. And he had a lovely singing voice, as my mother did.
But in terms of education, things were a bit rocky for you.
When I returned after the war at the age of 10, my education, formal education, was somewhat in tatters. And that was sad, but on the other hand, one I'd never live with regret. It was an experience that I treasure very much, the depth of community, the sense of excitement, at the same time, the great joy as war ended.
But it meant that you failed your 11 plus.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And although I passed the 13 plus as a late developer, but what I didn't realise that my dear mother and father had already decided, as I was so happy in my school, that they didn't want to disturb me. So, in fact, actually, they put it to me, wouldn't it be in your best interest to stay at the secondary modern school? Of course, I didn't know the real ins and outs of the implications of that, so I said, yes, why not? But it did mean that I left school without any formal qualifications.
So do you think that lack of academic background has fostered this determination that you obviously have to succeed, a kind of I'll show 'em kind of approach?
I have no doubt about that, actually. There's a sense in which those early war years, I think I grew up in a community which had a strong sense of class distinction. And I was aware, as I grew into my teens and later, that if I was going to get anywhere, then, of course, I had to fight for it.
Tell me about record number two.
Well, I met up with two young men, and perhaps I might be able to tell you about it in a moment, but I've chosen a wonderful piece of music which I discovered in my late teens. And this is Jupiter from the Planet Suite, and it brings back very important and wonderful memories of that particular period of my life.
Part of Jupiter from Holst's Planet Suite, played by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Now, how did that become part of your life in your teens, Dr. Carey?
Well, the war left me with lots of questions, and the questions were fairly philosophical in origin. What is this all about? Is there a God who cares? What kind of world is it? How do you make sense of the universe? And even though I was a teenager, you could still wrestle with these questions. And when I was about 16, 16 and a half, my brother, Bob, said to me one day, why don't you come along to the local church? There's a very good youth club along over there. So I went along with him. I met up with two young men, just slightly older than myself, David and John Harris, and they invited me around to their house, and they loved music, and they had a real record player, which I didn't have. And so every Saturday afternoon, perhaps not every Saturday afternoon, because I was quite keen on football, I went around to their house, and we often listened to records for 3-4 hours. The darkness would fall, and we'd still be there listening to the Dream of Dorontius and other things. They enlarged my musical horizons, and in a sense, art, music, and Christianity overlapped in a most mysterious way.
Do you stay in contact with them? Do you still?
Yes,
know
I do. Yes. I still hear from them from time to time, and of course, they are thrilled with the story of my development because they see very much they had a ministry to me at that particular period. Although, perhaps they would never put it in quite that way.
But was there a moment when you consciously became a Christian? Can you date the time and the place?
Yes, I can. I can date it to May 1953, just before I was called up to do my national service.
What happened? Can you describe it?
No, I can't really tell you that, Sue. It's just a strong, overwhelming feeling that I had found something deeply important. It was intellectual, it was a discovery, it was also very mystical and spiritual at the same time. It doesn't really matter so much about how it happened, the very fact it did happen.
But if anybody had told you or the Harris brothers or your family then that one day you'd become Archbishop of Canterbury, I wonder what your reaction would have been.
Well, my reaction would go, pull the other one, it's got bells on it, but no. At that particular stage, I didn't have any idea how my life was going to pan out at all.
Record number 3. What's that?
Well, what I've chosen now is Mozart, because that was a discovery too when I was a young person to find how wonderful Mozart's music is. I didn't even know the lovely story that Karl Barth once said, he's the theologian, he once said something like this, that when the angels are going about their business, they listen to Bach. But when they're relaxing in the evening, they listen to Mozart, and the good God listens with the greatest of pleasure.
Part of the third movement of Mozart's Symphony No. 40, played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham. And that, if I understand it correctly, became important to you during your national service in the mid-50s. Now, how, why, where, when?
Well, about 9 months after I made that decision and then started to embrace formal Christianity, I was called up to do my national service in the Royal Air Force as a wireless operator. So a year later, I found myself in Egypt and in Shaiba, which is was then a small air force base near Basra. See, what I found there was that I was one of 120 young men. There was no chaplain. One day I discovered a hut locked, and inside there was a piano, and it was obviously a chapel. About every 2 months, a chaplain would come down from Habania to take a communion service. So I asked the CEO if I could open it one day to start a little service. And a lad of my own age, slightly older, I think he was in the education department, joined me. He was a marvellous pianist. And so after the service, the occasional service that we had, out would come some wonderful Mozart. So I fell in love with that piece then.
When did you begin warming to the idea of ordination?
During that period in Shaiba, I remember one evening under the sky filled with stars, I started to think about what am I going to do in a year's time when I'm demobbed. I thought of education. And suddenly the thought came to me, why not study for the ordained ministry? And then sickening feeling in one's stomach, but I haven't got the qualifications. I would have to go to university and all that, and that troubled me. But, well, having put my hand to the plough, I decided that it was quite right to explore that when I returned home.
And so you did. And you got, if I've got the story right, you got 3 A-levels and 6 O's in just over a year.
Yes, it was something like that.
That's called determination, isn't it? That's called fairly single-minded ambition.
I was highly motivated, and obviously there was some ability there as well. But I just love the study. I'm still a student, and I still enjoy reading books and widening my knowledge.
Record number 4.
Well, I've chosen a fairly modern pop singer called Van Morrison, an Irishman. And he's got that a wonderful ability to bring together the modern style with something which is deeply mystical and spiritual. And I've chosen a song called Be Thou My Vision.
Be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Not be all else to me, save that thy art.
Van Morrison and Be Thou My Vision. You graduated in divinity, Archbishop, in the early 60s, and you were ordained and you became a curate in Islington and then a lecturer at various theological institutions. And then you became a vicar in Durham,
right,
which is where you developed your evangelical approach, isn't it? Now, where did that come from?
Well, I took over a city centre church. And when I took it over that particular point, the church was closed 6 days a week, open on a Sunday, when no one was around. And Durham is a very busy place. It was a Victorian building, a lot wrong with the building, and yet there was a faithful nucleus of people there. And it gave me a wonderful opportunity, and I want to say, together with the congregation, to do something quite new and quite exciting, and that was to develop a seven-day-a-week approach to the Christian faith and serving the wider community. And the lay people were very significant to the story, their vision, their energy, and so on. But it was simply flinging wide open the doors of the church, allowing fresh air to blow into it.
And you had an organisation called Agnostics Anonymous, didn't you?
Yes, I wanted to create an opportunity for people who were declared unbelievers or people who were searching for faith to come along to the vicarage, talk to me frankly, so we can actually have an intellectual discussion, exploring, knowledge, faith, understanding.
With the guarantee that there will be no prayers, no hymns, no preaching.
Nothing like that. No pressure whatsoever, just listening. All that I said I can guarantee is that my wife would make a very good cup of tea. You didn't offer coffee in Durham.
But somebody once said, didn't they, that the church is the only club that exists for its non-members.
Yes.
And at some point, presumably, you have to introduce the
Absolutely.
Subject of God.
I think it was William Temple, the great William Temple, who said that long ago. And he, for me, is a great model of what an archbishop ought to be like. Someone rooted in society, and someone who's open to new ideas, and yet unashamedly committed to the Christian faith in all its verity.
So what are you saying? Are you saying if you open your doors, as you say, and let the fresh air come in, and if you have modern music and dancing and activities and non-religious things, that at some point so many people will have come in that you can then bring God into play, religion into play?
All that, but at the same time not ditching and jettisoning the good things, the old things, the traditional things. We still have the Book of Common Prayer as a regular feature of our life, but we were trying to relate the Christian faith to all sorts and conditions of people.
But if the recipe is as simple as that for selling the church, then why isn't it happening across the land? I mean, I understand the figures now are that 95% of people do not go to church.
I can tell you, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy at all, but we did see people coming in great numbers, and that church is still very lively indeed. But it is happening. It is happening in many, many parts of the world, and not least in our own country. We often hear that the church is in decline. Well, statistics show that the church is bouncing back. There are churches growing, the good things are happening, and we don't have to go for gimmicks. I mean, this is the thing I want to underline. It is a matter of actually sane, intelligent Christianity, which is looking into the world and trying to apply what we believe to be the truth to the situation we find ourselves in.
That's what the traditionalists worried about when you were made Archbishop, wasn't it? That you were going to institute guitar playing in Lambeth Palace.
Yes, I hope I've reassured them that I have no wish to ditch anything that is important. And for me, the prayer book is a wonderful tool of worship. In Lambeth Palace Chapel, we use the prayer book more than any other form of liturgy. But we have to face the fact that the majority of young people now growing up are growing up without any knowledge of liturgy whatsoever. So we may bemoan the fact that their people do not understand the prayer book anymore, but somehow we've got to give a faith to them, and I'm quite unrepentant in saying that it really doesn't matter what form of liturgy we offer, as long as one that is relevant to their needs and their aspirations.
Tell me about your next record.
One of my favourite artists is Bob Newhart, and humour is deeply important to me, Sue. I often use stories and jokes in sermons and addresses because I think that's one way in which you connect with people, in one way in which you help them to relax. And this, of course, is famous description of the driving instructor and all that happens.
All right, let's pull into the alley up there and practice a little alley driving. This is... This is something a lot of the schools leave out that we think is pretty. You're going too fast, Mrs. Webb. You're up around 60, and it's kind of a sharp turn there. All right, let's just drive down the alley. That's the way. Mrs. Webb, maybe we better stop here. Well, I don't think you're going to make it between the truck and the building.
Bob Newhart and the driving instructor. It's very good. I can't imagine you delivering that in a sermon or anything like it. Are you?
No, I've often wanted to use it, but it's never been able to fit in any of my sermons yet.
Now, you're not a fence sitter, as you said. You lead from the front. You've made that plain all along, and you certainly did that over the ordination of women, didn't you? Mm. Against advice, because there were people who were saying to you, sit back and see what happens, but you decided you were going to lead from the front.
Yes, there was certainly advice being given to me at the time that it might be better to sit on the fence and wait and see what Synod decides, but it seemed to me that it was right, as Archbishop of Canterbury, I should take a lead. I didn't want the rest of the 90s to be taken up going through further discussion when it seemed to me that we were ready as a church to do it. So.
But you were, in a sense, effectively laying your job on the line in leading from the front, as we've said. What are you going to do on an issue that now faces you, perhaps an even more controversial issue, that of the church and homosexuality?
I think we've really got to put this in perspective. What comes first, which is much more important than the ordination of women, homosexuality, or any single issue like that, is the mission of the church and the future of the church in our land.
But what about the issue of homosexuality? Because earlier this year, the Anglican Communion certainly signalled that it was prepared to initiate a process which could eventually lead to the recognition of gay relationships. Now, are you leading from the front on this one?
Well, I am, and indeed want to say on that issue, it wasn't actually as clear as that, the way you put it. But what we're talking about is that we have to engage with the questions that people have focusing on these days, but we do so in the light of Scripture and the Christian tradition. That comes first and foremost to me, and for most of the primates as well.
But the traditionalists would say that as far as the Bible is concerned, homosexuality is an abomination.
I share with them their commitment to the Bible, and certainly would want to assure them that in no way am I wanting to ditch that or to turn over the clear teaching of Scripture. But with that must go to the listening to the experience of men and women today whose experience may be different from ours.
But do you foresee a time, and maybe it's a decade away, who knows, do you foresee a time when the church will recognise gay relationships?
I don't think that's a question I want to answer, Sue, this particular point, in quite that way. I don't see that as a reality facing the church at this present time.
But you'll go on debating and you'll go on talking about it. You'll go on and listening to both sides of the argument.
The Anglican Church is the kind of church which is not authoritarian. We do listen seriously to questions, and that is my commitment too.
But are you sitting more on the fence in this one than you were over women's ordination?
I think you'll have to wait and see, but I don't think I've done so far.
Record number six.
Well, record number six is a hymn that means so much to my wife Eileen and myself. We had it on our wedding day. It's followed us through our life at every big moment of our life, our baptism of our children, even the enthronement as Archbishop of Canterbury. Oh, praise ye the Lord.
Oh, Praise Ye the Lord, sung by the choir of King's College, Cambridge. What effect has being Archbishop of Canterbury had on your family life? It must have put it under enormous pressure at times.
Yes, it has indeed. Luckily, my family were all grown up when I received the invitation to become Archbishop of Canterbury. It has been quite a challenge to both of us, to Eileen and myself, but she has been so supportive, and she's a most remarkable person in her own right, deeply intelligent, completely loyal and fearless. With her own gifts, she was trained as a nurse in London, and wherever we go on our travels, she takes a particular interest in medical matters. But yes, it has been quite an effect on our children as well, although from a distance, where they've been tremendously supportive, and it's been fun to have them around supporting me when the times have been hard.
Because they have been hard. The press has not given you an easy time, has it?
I don't think they give an easy time to any public figure, but I don't complain about that. One of the great joys about our society is that we delight in a free press, and journalists have to do their jobs. And if I can learn from their criticism, all well and good.
This is a very Christian attitude, if I may say. There have been times when they've seemed to be gunning for you or accusing you of making yet another gaffe. There must be times when you thought, oh,
well,
blow them.
What I hope sometime they will start to do is if they tot up the gaffes as against the things that I've said they've been prophetically right and positive and courageous, they may well find that the goals outnumber the failures or mishits.
Number seven.
Yes, well, this record, Chopin's Etude, number 3 in E major, opus number 10, I heard years and years ago. For me, it's one of the most beautiful pieces of piano music ever. It's so wistful, sad, and yet at the same time irradiates hope and joy.
Part of Chopin's Etude No. 3 in E major, opus 10, played by Vladimir Ashkenazy. You've often been compared in the press, Archbishop, to John Major. You're both men of humble origins, self-taught in many respects, both like a game of football, or watching it at least. Do you get on with each other?
Oh, yes, we get on very well indeed. I think he's a splendid person. He's a man of great integrity, and he's his contributions, especially in Northern Ireland, is very impressive indeed.
But would you often pick up the phone in Lambeth Palace and speak to him?
Yes, I have spoken to him often in that kind of way, and as I would with any public figure.
Didn't happen a lot between Mrs. Thatcher and your predecessor, though, did it?
I think the same relationship was there, deep loyalty, but my predecessor coined the phrase a critical creative relationship. In other words, that it is important for the church to be detached from issues of government policy, but be able to make its own viewpoint, as I do, as you know, from time to time, on prison work or whatever it is. You know, you want to give a distinctive church slant on a particularly important issue.
But politicians don't always like it, though, do they?
No, that's very much up to them to take it or leave it as they choose. But on the whole, most of them appreciate it.
Now, if you could leave all that behind you, which is what we offer here, and set sail for this desert island and shed the onus of high office, would you welcome that?
Do you know, I think I could find it quite difficult. On the one hand, maybe the spiritual truths that I value, it's very much at the heart of my life, would give me the resources to cope. I'm sure it would. But at the same time, I'm a very gregarious person. I love having family and people around me. So perhaps I could put up with it, Sue, for a week or two. After that, it could get very stressful indeed.
But you'd survive, no doubt.
I'm pretty sure I would survive because my faith is deep-rooted and I'm a man of hope as well.
You're an optimist. Not just a man who meets a challenge head-on, but somebody who is essentially and deep down optimistic, yes?
Yes, I am basically optimistic. My wife will at times say to me when we go on holiday that I will always say we will never get everything in that case, and she is usually proved right. But basically, I'm optimistic about human nature. I'm optimistic about the universe because it's God's universe and he will have the last word.
We'll have your last record.
My last record is Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. It reminds me once again of the war years. I can remember the celebrations in 1945, and I think I discovered this music for the first time around that particular time, as we celebrated together, as we had the street parties, as we celebrated a wonderful victory, and at the same time remembered all those who had fallen. Over 50 million people died in the last war. And so that victory was tinged with deep regret and deep sorrow as well.
The end of Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, played by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Archbishop.
It will have to be O Praise Ye the Lord, to remind me of the great pleasure of having a wonderful, supportive family around me all my life.
And what about your book? You've got the Bible waiting for you, and you've got the complete works of Shakespeare.
Well, I would enjoy reading both of those from cover to cover again and again. I'm very fond of the writings and poetry of T.S. Eliot, and I would love to take the complete works away with me and go back again and again to that wonderful poem, East Coker, because East Coker was in my diocese of Bath and Wells. I often went there, and that is where his ashes now reside.
So we'll allow you the four quartets, but not the complete works.
Definitely. Well, I'll settle for that. Thank you, Sue, very much indeed.
What about your luxury?
Well, my luxury, how difficult this is. I have decided what I would do is ask for two things. First of all, if you will allow me to take a computer with me and an empty bottle. Now, with the computer, I would like to type up a book because I love writing, and the book will be How to Cope with Loneliness. And write as a spiritual leader, then I, having completed that, I would pop it in the empty bottle and send it off to my literary agent.
Dr. George Carey, Archbishop of Canterbury, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Sue, very much indeed.